You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, tax day is next week, and our guest says the Earned Income Tax Credit has been a big help for working families here in Wisconsin.
First, we're recapping what happened at the polls yesterday. Texas Senator Ted Cruz won 36 of Wisconsin's 42 Republican delegates, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders won 47 of the state's 86 Democratic delegates.
After heated debates with her opponent, Joanne Kloppenburg, Rebecca Bradley was called as the winner of Wisconsin's Supreme Court race late last night.
And Milwaukee's Mayor Tom Barrett was also reelected for his fourth term yesterday. Here to give us a recap of what happened at the polls is WPR's Milwaukee-based reporter Chuck Kornbach. Chuck, welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief is with us too, Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the presidential primary. Sean, any correlation between who spent the most time in Wisconsin and who won last night?
Well, I think you would say that Bernie Sanders spent a lot of time in Wisconsin, and he did win last night. But you'd also say that Donald Trump, toward the last week, spent a lot of time here. I'm not sure that correlated with more votes for him. I think the stage was basically set for Ted Cruz to do well here after a certain number of other Republicans dropped out of the race, particularly Marco Rubio. I mean, if you look at the last poll when Rubio was still in the race, Donald Trump was kind of at that 30% ceiling. Once Rubio got out, those votes seemed to go to Ted Cruz, and just as importantly, the Republican Party establishment and talk radio all basically decided in unison, Cruz is going to be our guy. Our primary goal is to defeat Donald Trump, and at least in Wisconsin last night they did.
And Chuck, a huge turnout yesterday, 47.4% turnout. Do you have any sense of what made this race such a hot ticket item in Wisconsin?
Well, the competitiveness, of course, and as Sean was saying, Donald Trump draws people, supporters and critics on the Democratic side. Both Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, both would be, landmark presidential elected folks if they make it. All sorts of things draw people to the polls. It helps to have charismatic candidates.
And Sean, Wisconsin has been described as a polarized state for years now. That's not new anymore. But looking at last night's results, can we draw any conclusions about where we are when it comes to political extremes and whether people have moved farther in one direction or the other?
Well, if you look at the exit polls, people had basically gotten more liberal and more conservative over the years. So that's not exactly in the results, but in the exit polls, if you look at the results themselves, and who won last night, Bernie Sanders is more liberal than Hillary Clinton, and he had a commanding win in that primary. Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, Donald Trump is sort of this unusual cobbled together coalition, as far as Republicans go. A lot of Republicans think he's not an actual Republican. But the guy who won, Ted Cruz, very conservative. I mean, much more conservative than, say, Mitt Romney or John McCain. So you kind of see that trend playing out in who won Wisconsin last night.
And Chuck, Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side won the day yesterday. What do we know about why Wisconsin voters felt that they resonated more with what Bernie Sanders had to say on the Democratic side?
Well, in attending some of his rallies, he certainly drew a lot of young people to those events. He drew a lot of people that felt a little bit left out of the economic system and yet are left of center socially. Hillary Clinton at a dinner in Milwaukee Saturday drew a lot of support, a lot of cheering to her speech. But, Sanders had maybe more of a connection with folks around the state. Hillary Clinton, I think, won Milwaukee County, but elsewhere where there was not as much connection to the establishment, perhaps, Madison and elsewhere, a little more progressive areas, went solidly for Sanders and helped him win by, what was the latest count, about 120,000 votes.
And we're talking right now with Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, and Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter in Milwaukee. And Chuck, we're going to pivot now to look at Milwaukee County. Two officials reelected there, Mayor Tom Barrett and County Board Executive Chris Abele. Did this come as a surprise to anyone?
Maybe not. The margin of victory for Barrett, 60,000 votes roughly out of about 150,000 cast. He defeated Bob Donovan, Alderman Bob Donovan, who had significant police and fire union support, but apparently not a lot of other backing. Barrett won handily, so maybe the margin of Barrett's win there was not expected, but certainly the fact that he won was fairly certain going into the last few days or last few weeks. On the county executive side, incumbent Chris Abley defeating State Senator Chris Larson. Let's just say Abley had put a lot of money into mailings, TV ads, and so on in the last few weeks to try to seal the deal. Larson says he couldn't keep up. Larson had some union support, but Abley had backing from other unions, the Building and Trades Council, and so on. And so it was just Abley's... Abley has avoided a scandal, I would say, and the fact that he worked with Governor Walker occasionally on some things and yet criticized Walker at the same time, too, on other things, saying he was not a Walker guy, maybe was the right tone for Milwaukee County.
And, Sean, we're going to turn to the state Supreme Court race now with Justice Rebecca Bradley and Joanne Kloppenburg, a nonpartisan race at face value. Bradley ended up winning. Who turned out for Bradley last night?
I think, well, we know that Republicans turned out for her. If you look at just the statewide vote yesterday, a lot more Republicans turned out than Democrats in terms of who voted in that primary versus the Democratic primary. And so then I think it's, we can't see all their ballots, but as you look at it, it looks like she benefited from that. It also looks like if you dig down into Milwaukee's numbers, Rebecca Bradley may have even picked up some of those Clinton or Sanders votes that Joanne Kloppenburg, who's favored by Democrats, ran well behind Bernie and Hillary in Milwaukee, the city. And Rebecca Bradley actually ran well ahead of them and so likely was picking up support from unusual places there.
And we leave it there. I want to thank you both. Chuck Kornbuck in Milwaukee, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Sean Johnson here at our Madison studios, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in just a few minutes, a look at the impact of the Earned Income Tax Credit for working families.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. On April 5th, 1860, as tensions over slavery grew, Wisconsin Congressman John F. Potter was challenged to a duel by a pro-slavery colleague from Virginia. The argument led to a huge 6-foot-long, 32-pound knife and a story that made Potter famous. Gilman Halstead brings us that story.
It was April 5th of 1860. Just a year later, the Civil War would begin. On the floor of Congress, Illinois Congressman Owen Lovejoy was gesticulating wildly as he delivered a blistering attack on slavery. Here's how UW historian William Heseltine described the scene in an article he wrote in 1943.
Up jumped Virginia Congressman Roger Pryor and shook his fist in Lovejoy's face, while other pro-slavery congressmen shouted out derisive comments like Negro thief, and the meanest Negro in the South is your superior. Republicans on the other side of the aisle rose in defense of Lovejoy's abolitionist speech. Among them, Wisconsin's John Fox Potter of Walworth County, his great black mustache bristling.
A few days later, Roger Pryor challenged John Fox Potter to a duel. He claimed Potter had tampered with the congressional record by inserting language that was not part of the debate. Here's how Potter remembers it from an interview he gave to the Chicago Tribune in 1896.
That afternoon, I got a note from Pryor challenging me to meet him in mortal combat. I believe that Pryor's object in proposing a duel was to obtain an easy and cheap renown in his own section. I thought, after all that had taken place, it was not my duty to decline to fight. But I was not a good shot with a pistol, and I did not purpose to have any hair-trigger business. I proposed to bring the combat down to the first principles of human butchery. Therefore, I accepted his challenge, with the stipulation the weapons should be Bowie knives, and the encounter should take place in a closed room, and the fight to go on till one or the other of us fell. Pryor refused on the grounds that the terms were barbarous. I replied that the custom of dueling itself was barbarous and inhuman.
The duel never happened. District of Columbia police arrested both men to keep the peace and then released them on bond after tempers had cooled. But as historian William Heseltine writes, Congressman Potter became a hero for his willingness to defy Southern braggadocio.
From all parts of the country, Bowie knives came to Representative Potter. And the following month, the Missouri delegation to the Republican convention in Chicago carried a 7-foot Bowie knife to present to the redoubtable champion of Northern honor.
To add insult to the already injured Southern pride, the knife was inscribed with a pun that made fun of the Virginian Roger Pryor. It read, "To John Fox Potter, who will always meet a prior engagement." Potter was reelected to another term and was known for the rest of his life as Bowie Knife Potter. The knife, dubbed the Monster Knife by journalists in the 1860s, became a powerful symbol of Northern opposition to slavery. As Potter remembers,
"We all felt that the time had come for some Northern man to lay aside his scruples and strike one blow that would convince the South that we were not to be bullied any longer."
A year later, the duel with Bowie knives that never happened erupted into a real shooting war.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Now, tax day is less than a week away, and many families in Wisconsin will get a refund because of the Earned Income Tax Credit.
The credit is aimed at low-income working families, and our next guest says it makes a big difference in household budgets and the economy as a whole.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin joins us now. She's a sociologist and assistant professor at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, why do we have the Earned Income Tax Credit? What was the intention of that?
So it was actually created in the 1970s just to refund the taxes that lower income workers were paying. So it was kind of giving them back what they had put in recognition of the fact that they were working and contributing, but their earnings were pretty low. And over the decades, it's expanded greatly. So now it's doing far more than that and giving families a big cushion to help them out during the year.
And the reasoning behind that, is this for the economy's benefit, for the benefit of individual families, or a little bit of both?
Well, it was expanded pretty drastically under President Bill Clinton in the early 1990s. And his words were that he wanted this to help make work pay. So again, this idea that we have some people who are doing jobs that don't pay them enough for them to get by, don't pay them enough to meet the needs of their families. And so this would help give them a boost. It certainly does have benefits to the larger economy because people spend those dollars. And so they go out into the businesses in the communities where people receive the money.
Is there an idea that this replaced or is in place of what we used to call a welfare benefit?
So it didn't replace what we think of as welfare, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which is what it's known as federally. It's really targeted at people with earned income, whereas welfare is targeted at people who don't really have much in the way of earned income. And they really work in opposite directions. So the more you earn, if you're enrolled in the welfare program, the less you get. In the Earned Income Tax Credit, the way it works is the more you earn, the more you get back up to a certain point.
Is the idea there? Well, as you said, it's an incentive to work. Do we know if it works?
Yes. So there's actually some really interesting research that's been done that showed that the Earned Income Tax Credit actually did more to draw low-income single mothers into the workforce in the 1990s than did the changes to our cash welfare program. So it seems to play a big role in making it pay off for people who are earning very little to actually pay the costs of going into the workforce, like getting child care, paying for transportation, those sorts of things.
Yeah, there's a big move of welfare to work programs here in Wisconsin as a leader in that, really, in the country, and then nationwide. You're saying this Earned Income Tax Credit may have worked a lot, or somewhat at least, better than a lot of those efforts?
Yeah. So people, the earned income tax credit was actually expanded before welfare was officially reformed at the federal level. And some research is showing that the earned income tax credit did more to draw people into the workforce than welfare did to sort of push them into the workforce. So the carrot in that sense worked better than the stick.
We're talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She's a sociologist at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, looking at the earned income tax credit as the big tax deadline comes up later this month. Is everyone who's supposed to be taking advantage of this program, everybody who's eligible, actually doing it? Are people getting this benefit?
So nationwide, and both in Wisconsin, the take-up rate is around 80%, which means around 8 out of 10 people who are eligible for the program are actually getting the benefit. That varies a little bit depending on whether people have children or not. And people with kids are actually a little bit more likely to get the benefit if they're eligible than people without.
Now, what's the scale? How many people are benefiting from the earned income tax credit here in Wisconsin and around the nation?
So I think people might really be staggered by this if they hadn't heard about the program before, because around 28 million households in the United States benefit from the earned income tax credit each year. In Wisconsin, it really varies county by county. So in Dane County, about 1 in 10 families is benefiting from the earned income tax credit. In some other counties in Wisconsin, it's as many as 1 in 5 families are benefiting from the earned income tax credit. So it's really pretty common.
Is there talk of any kind of change needed or maybe in the works for earned income tax credit? Or is this a policy item that most people are keeping their hands off?
Well, so there were some changes as part of the Recovery Act. There was an expanded benefit made available for families with 3 children. Previously, there had only been additional benefits if you had 1 or 2 children and no further benefits. So that was expanded. There has been discussion about the need to potentially have a more generous credit available for people who don't have a dependent child to claim, particularly non-custodial parents, especially those who are making their child support payments but can't claim their child for tax purposes. Also extending the benefits to them in recognition of their work and support of their children.
We've been focusing kind of big picture here. Can you talk about what a working family might be doing with this earned income tax credit? What kind of things can they do that they wouldn't be able to without it?
Yeah, so in research that I've done, the families we met were really living paycheck to paycheck during the course of the year. And so tax time was the one sort of time of the year where they could lift their heads up and say, what do we really need? What are some of the big purchases we need to make? So for some families, that might mean buying a used car and giving you access to jobs that might be farther out, not available by public transportation. For other families, it's doing things like getting caught up on your debt. Lots of families have debts during the course of the year, and tax time is a great time to get caught up. Other families commonly do things like just paying the bills, right? I'm going to pay my car insurance. I'm going to pay my my light bill. I'm going to pay my rent, doing those sorts of things. We saw that about $1 out of 10 that people received from their tax refund went to treats. Those treats were typically smaller things like, you know, taking the kids out for a meal at a sit-down restaurant, but they were really meaningful to people. So people talked about them more than they actually spent money on them because it felt great to them to get to do those sorts of things for their kids that they usually had to say no to during most of the year.
And there's been a lot of talk about a lack of savings in a lot of American families. I imagine these working families in particular, whether we're talking about saving for a possible college education for kids or further ahead for retirement. Is the earned income tax credit part of that equation?
Yes, the earned income tax credit is part of that equation. For some families, what the earned income tax credit means is a chance to get out of debt. And that's really essential in terms of improving your financial well-being, right? So getting out of debt is the first step before you can really engage in savings. For families who are on better footing going into tax season, they do save part of that earned income tax credit. It can be put towards the costs of purchasing a house. It can be put towards the costs of a college education or children's schooling costs, and some families do. But typically, they need to be on relatively stable financial footing going into tax season in order to be able to use the money that way.
And finally, again, tax time is coming up. You said about 80% of people who can use the earned income tax credit are using it. Are there efforts to make sure that other 20% knows what they can get?
So there are some efforts. There are an array of ways that you can file your taxes. So the ones we see most prominently are the ones that are advertised on TV by for-profit tax preparers. But there are also nonprofit organizations that offer free tax preparation, what are called volunteer income tax assistance sites. And so you can go get your taxes filed for free in those places. There are also some online tax preparation software companies that will offer free tax preparation for lower income filers. And so I think those are some options where people can go to file their taxes and make sure they're getting the benefits that they're eligible for.
We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sarah Halperin-Meekin from the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's author of the book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. She's been talking about the Earned Income Tax Credit.
Coming up, recent research finds many older Americans at risk from prescription drug interactions. We'll find out what to watch out for. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 7 this evening, great storytelling from Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, the world has a natural order that we all abide, except when we don't. It's coming up after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a new study revealed some alarming findings about older Americans and their use of prescription drugs, over-the-counter medications, and supplements. The study was done by researchers at the University of Illinois Chicago and found that as many as 1 in 6 older adults is taking a combination of medications that could be dangerous.
Dr. Dima Kato is one of the authors of that study. She's an assistant professor of pharmacy systems, outcomes, and policy at the University of Illinois Chicago. Dr. Kato, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, this finding, 1 in 6 older adults regularly using potentially deadly combinations of prescription drugs and other medications and supplements, is this an increase over previous research, or is this just getting an initial handle on how big a problem this is?
This is actually an increase compared to what we found in 2005. 8%, it's still high. So in 2005, we found that 8% of older adults, or 1 in 12, were at risk for a dangerous drug interaction. And our study revealed that it doubled to 1 in 6, or 15%.
Well, I guess the big question then is why? Why are we seeing this increase in potentially harmful mixes of medications?
I think there's multiple reasons why we may be seeing an increase. One is that older adults are also using more medications. We found that over a five-year period, the use of 5 or more prescription drugs increased from 30% to around 36%. I think with Medicare Part D, more generics going on the market for some of the commonly used drugs, drugs are becoming more accessible. So that may be driving the increased use of drugs, which, you know, the more drugs you use, the more likely you're going to experience an interaction.
And you're finding zero in on older adults specifically. Is that just because this is a demographic that has health conditions that tend to require more medications?
Right. So, yeah, they're usually sicker. Older adults are usually sicker, have multiple conditions that require multiple medications. So drug interactions are more common, or polypharmacy is more common, or the use of multiple medications is more common. But, you know, a previous study looked at the use of prescription medications in the adult population, and they found that more adults are increasing using prescription medications. So while we focused on older adults in our study, I think it's a problem that affects everyone in the U.S. or all Americans, given the increased use of prescription medications overall across all demographics.
From the side of the medical profession, is there a sense that we're doing enough to track, if we're doctors, pharmacists, healthcare providers, enough to track our patients when we prescribe medications?
Well, you know, obviously not enough. We're seeing growing risk in older adults. It's getting worse. It's not getting better, which signals that there is a problem or that we're not addressing, at least not sufficiently. And I think part of it is, you know, doctors asking patients what they're on, not just prescriptions, but also over-the-counter drugs and dietary supplements. All the medications they're on, because especially older adults, they see multiple doctors oftentimes, and they don't always reveal all the drugs they're on, not because they don't want to or not don't intend to, but they're never asked or not asked as much as they should be. And I think patients should also tell, even if they're not asked, they should tell physicians and pharmacists all the medications they're on, and that could help identify combinations that are potentially dangerous.
Talking to Dr. Dima Kato from the University of Illinois Chicago about a new report that finds 1 in 6 older Americans have potentially harmful combinations of prescription drugs and along with supplements and over-the-counter medications. Let's talk about the potential for harm, Dr. Kato. And I know we're talking about a huge variety of potential bad outcomes, but well, what kind of risks are we talking about here?
So depending on the combination, the risks could vary, but most of these risks are actually cardiovascular risks, increased risk of bleeding, increased risk for a heart attack or a stroke, increased risk of muscle breakdown and renal failure. Those are the most common risks or the adverse effects associated with the drug interactions that we've identified to be the most common in the older adult population.
We'll get in a minute to some of the potential combinations that maybe people should watch out for, but I want to get more general here for patients, either older patients themselves or maybe a caregiver who's accompanying them to a doctor's office. What should they do? What's a good way for them to track what they're taking and to communicate that to the healthcare professionals?
They should maintain a list of all the drugs they're on, and whenever they think they need to take a supplement or over-the-counter drug, they should check with their pharmacist if they're at the pharmacy, which is where you usually purchase supplements and over-the-counter medications, and really seek information on the risks associated with taking these medications together with all the drugs they're on. So a caregiver, for example, could maintain a list of prescription medications that the patient is using regularly, and when they feel the need to use an over-the-counter drug, or if a new prescription medication is prescribed, they make sure they explicitly ask about interactions. And if the doctor doesn't ask, or inform the patient should, or the caregiver should ask the doctor.
And do you think a lot of people take the supplements or the over-the-counter medicines for granted? Like, you might have been taking ibuprofen or aspirin all your life and never thought about it. You might buy a multivitamin or herbal supplement at a store and think, well, this isn't a medication. It's not a drug. Do we just take that stuff for granted while we're taking these prescription medications?
I think so. I think, the public may assume just because a medication is available over-the-counter or a supplement is available without a prescription, that it's safe. And I think that's a problem, because that's not true. Just because you can get a medication or a supplement without a doctor's visit, without a prescription, doesn't mean that it's safe, and it also doesn't mean that it's safe to take with your other medications.
I wonder if we're taking two different things at a time, that's one thing. Does it get way more complicated when we're talking about 4 or 5 different medications that it could all be interacting with one another? It ends up being a medical chaos in a way. Is that part of the problem?
Right, and that's why it's important to keep track of all the medications you're on, because interactions are real. They're a real problem, and they affect your life. I mean, they could be really dangerous, and they're avoidable. I mean, if you don't benefit from taking a drug, particularly in a certain combination, then you shouldn't be taking it. That's really the bottom line.
Is part of the answer here maybe we're prescribing too many medications, that we should prioritize some conditions and let others be a watchful waiting situation to avoid these interactions?
I think so. That's part of the problem. Another part of the problem is that there's a lot of medications and supplements that are available to the public, easily accessible. It's really hard not to take them or purchase them, that have limited evidence of benefits, right? So aside from the interaction risk, they're really not as beneficial as they appear to be to a patient or to the public. And that's a problem, especially considering that we know that so many people are on prescription drugs that are potentially beneficial. So it could really thwart efforts to improve health, improve survival, and could, you know, be disastrous if it's not resolved.
Are there particular categories of medication where we should be really watchful? If you're taking this kind of medication, be very aware of potential interactions with other medications.
Yeah, so, I mean, many of the interactions involve key medications. The class is statins, right? Everyone knows statins, maybe according to our study. A lot of people are on statins.
These are a cholesterol medication,
cholesterol-lowering
probably the most popular
medication.
One, yeah.
Right, exactly. And they're becoming increasingly popular, and we found that one of the most common interactions is an interaction with simvastatin, which is the generic for Zocor, which became available as a generic, actually, after 2006. And we found that not only has the use of simvastatin increased, but an interaction with amlodipine, which is antihypertensive, so a drug used to lower blood pressure, that's usually the indication for it. So we found that that combination increased from 1% in 2005 to 4% of the older adult population in 2010, 2011. That's a fourfold increase.
And are these things that should just in general never be taken together?
Well, there's alternatives. I mean, I can't say never. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, it's all, every patient is different, and a physician has to weigh the risks versus the benefit. But in general, there's alternatives to both of those medications. And they're used to treat or prevent cardiovascular or promote cardiovascular health, both of them, right? Simvastatin is used to lower cholesterol, to prevent cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and stroke, amlodipine, antihypertensive. Hypertension is a risk factor or high blood pressure for cardiovascular disease. But that combination increases your risk for muscle breakdown and renal failure, which are serious risks, particularly in the elderly. And they should be avoided, especially if there's other alternatives.
And this might be a pretty common pair of things to take together because, as you say, ultimately they're both about heart health. If you've got a
exactly.
patient with a high risk factor for heart disease, for heart attacks, you'd be looking at the cholesterol, you'd be looking at that high blood pressure.
But you may not be looking at their renal function. You may not be looking at their, you know, the side effect of, you know, muscle weakness and breakdown.
We're talking to Dr. Dima Kato about a new study that she participated in. She's with the University of Illinois Chicago. This study looks at the risks of drug interactions facing many older Americans.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you or a loved one on multiple medications? Have you talked about possible interactions with your doctor or your pharmacist? And if you have, did you think to mention over-the-counter drugs or supplements that you're also taking? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion about a new report that looks at the risks that older adults face when taking a combination of prescription drugs, over-the-counter medications, and supplements.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in this situation where you're taking multiple medications or maybe a caregiver for someone who does? How do you communicate with a doctor, a pharmacist, with healthcare providers about possible interactions? Do you carry that list with you when you go to the pharmacy, when you go to visit the doctor? And do you include on that list the vitamin, the fish oil supplement, the herbal supplement, the aspirin, the ibuprofen? And if you're a healthcare provider, how do you deal with this issue, possible drug interactions at your clinic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Dima Kato stays with us, author of the new study, co-author, assistant professor at the University of Illinois Chicago. Dr. Kato, you mentioned one very common interaction between a cholesterol medication and a blood pressure medication. Any other ones that end up being in this mix of multiple prescriptions that we should be worried about?
Of course. So there's Many of these interactions also involve anticoagulants and antiplatelets, specifically aspirin with clopidogrel, which is the generic for Plavix, which also became generic, available as a generic over the last several years. We also have, which could increase, so that combination, aspirin and clopidogrel, antiplatelet, both often used in the prevention of clotting, could increase your risk of bleeding. Bleeding, major bleeding, so gastrointestinal bleeding, bleeding strokes, so it's a major problem that's potentially fatal. Also warfarin, a drug that's commonly used, and omega-3 fish oil. That combination could increase your risk for bleeding as well.
Now, I know a problem sometimes in the healthcare profession is the handoff. When someone goes from, in a hospital, one shift to another, one doctor to another, or a general practitioner in their life and this or that specialist, maybe the heart doctor, are we getting better at communicating between healthcare providers and between clinics to make sure, hey, everybody has all that information on file?
I think the healthcare system is getting there with healthcare reform, the Affordable Care Act, and accountable care organizations, but I think it hasn't been fully implemented across the U.S., across all communities. And, you know, given that we found that it's gotten worse over time, I think it's really important that we do that, that we not only integrate care, but particularly when we're talking about medications in transitions of care, that everyone knows all the time what patients are taking. Not just prescription drugs, but also over-the-counter drugs and supplements, because we do know that they're available to them, and we know that they're taking them, potentially. So we should be very, we should work harder in making sure that we get that information from the patients and evaluate it. So we use that information, we actually evaluate it, and we make sure that it's all the medications are safe, they're beneficial, and they should be taken together.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Jackie on the line in Appleton. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I'm an interpreter, and it's funny. I've been listening to the radio today because my boss and I just had a conversation about this earlier today. As an interpreter, we're in the medical field, medical setting quite a bit, and we've noticed that a lot of new drugs are being named similar names to drugs that already exist. And as an interpreter, sometimes that pulls is a struggle for us, seeing that our clients aren't always clear on exactly which drug we're referring to. Is there a reason for this, or is there a way we can try to avoid it or prevent it in the future?
Interesting, Jackie. And Dr. Cotto, I imagine that can be a problem even when there's not an interpreter in the equation, when there are two similarly named drugs, maybe with very different effects.
Right. No, it could be part of the problem for sure. I'm not exactly sure what drugs you're referring to, but I think confusion, drug name confusion or duplication could be a problem, not only in terms of interactions, because you don't know what the drugs are or if they're the same or whatever, but for just any kind of clinical issue.
Jackie, thanks for that call, and good luck dealing with that issue in your job as an interpreter. We're talking about drug interactions, prescriptions sometimes, prescription drugs and over-the-counter, and supplements with Dr. Dima Cotto. New study finds that 1 in 6 older Americans have potentially dangerous drug interactions included in their mix of prescriptions. And Jackie's question, Dr. Cotto, speaks to this communication issue, and we hear that a lot, that this is something we need to improve in our healthcare system between patients and providers and between, again, different providers dealing with the same patient. Is that something you see maybe hopefully improving over time?
I'm optimistic. I think so. I think you're right. I mean, communicating not just the benefits of drugs but the risks is important, whether it's the risks associated with the use of a drug alone or the risks associated with the use of a medication in combinations. I think we need to get better at that, and we need to inform patients that they should feel comfortable telling us about all the medications they're on, because, you know, it may not be safe to take them all together.
And I've heard recommendations, I think, on interviews I've done in the past, that people taking a lot of medications, especially people who might, due to health conditions, be prone to an urgent care or an emergency room visit, to have that list of medications on them at all times, a bracelet even, or that notebook with their list. Is that a recommendation for people in that situation?
Of course, yeah. I think that would help the health, you know, the emergency room personnel and everyone if they know everything you're on. And that list should be comprehensive, so it shouldn't be incomplete. That would be the most helpful.
We'll take another caller now, Adeline in Racine. Adeline, hi.
Hi. Is there anything wrong with taking Simvastatin with Lisinopril?
Oh, well, that's a pretty specific question, Dr. Cotter. I don't know if you have that at your fingertips, but if you do, wonderful. If not, is there a reference, a way that a patient can go to try to cross-reference two different medications?
Yeah, so there's some websites that are available online. I mean, first, I would recommend you ask your physician who either prescribed both of those medications or one of them, hopefully both. Two, you can go on. I mean, there's several publicly available websites that you can check for interactions. One I know is through Medscape, another through the National Institutes of Health. I don't have the website on me right now, but you can find out online. But again, the preference would be to discuss it with your pharmacist and your primary care provider.
So in our last minute or so, Dr. Cotto, can you leave us with some advice for patients, especially people taking two or more prescription medications, to make sure they avoid the risk of these interactions?
I think, you know, if you're on even one medication and you're started on a new medication, or if you're on more than two medications, you really need to check with your physician, your pharmacist, whether those medications are safe to take together. And whenever you decide to take an over-the-counter drug or a supplement, whatever the motivation is, you also should check if they're safe to take with your prescription medications, because sometimes they could actually thwart any benefits that you are hoping to get from, you know, the medications you're on. And you want to make sure that, you know, you're taking medications that are beneficial to your health and not risky.
Well, Dr. Cotto, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Dr. Dima Cotto. She's an assistant professor of pharmacy systems, outcomes, and policy at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She and some of her colleagues involved in this recent research on the impact of drug interactions, finding one in six older Americans in particular have potentially dangerous combinations of prescription medication. You can find more information, share your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, political junkie Ken Rudin joins the show for a look at a wild presidential election year.
In the job world today, our guest says we don't have careers anymore, but a series of employment episodes. And she has advice to help us be flexible and adaptable.
And a recent UW graduate explains his experience with the Real UW hashtag movement, an effort to highlight issues of race at UW-Madison.
That and a look at the top news stories of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Coming up tomorrow at 8, Joy talks with an author whose book 25 years ago challenged the myths surrounding American families. She says her research proves that marriage isn't dying, but also that nuclear families were never the all-important institution that they've been made out to be. That's tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll get a recap of the Wisconsin presidential primary. The big news last night, we'll have Harry Enten from the website 538.com for our weekly look at the national political scene and what's going on the presidential campaign trail. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.